Attention all listeners on this frequency. Stand by for an important announcement.
Welcome to Medic Podcast, the weekly podcast for EMS providers, EMS leaders, EMS medical directors, and others involved in or those who have an interest in emergency medical services. Ladies and gentlemen, here's your host, Steve Cohen.
Coming from the Whatcom County Emergency Medical Services Studios is another episode of Medic to Medic Podcast. Hi, it's Steve Cohen. You can download this episode at Apple Podcasts, Speaker, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Stitcher. You can reach the host at medictomedicpodcast@gmail.com. Today, I get to welcome back my medical director, Dr. Marvin Wayne, who is a legend in emergency medical services. He's been around for, well, I'll let him tell you how long he's been around. He's also the key architect to the Whatcom County Emergency Medical Services. Plus, he spent some time in Vietnam as a trauma surgeon. You can listen to his previous podcast on Medic to Medic. I can't remember what episode it was, but it was before I got hired here. He came on and was very gracious to spend some time with me on that podcast. So, Marv, welcome back to Medic to Medic Podcast.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be back.
So just refresh our listeners about your history in emergency medical service as well as a physician.
Well, my career started as a trauma surgeon. I was trained in Denver, and then I got the opportunity, good, bad, or indifferent, to fulfill my Berry Plan deferral, and I was off to Vietnam, where I served as a year at the 24th Evacuation Hospital. And then my second year was in Colorado Springs. My third year was in Seattle. And then decided I wanted to make a career change and move from the surgical end of the world to the emergency medical end. And eventually, with the evolution of the system here in Bellingham, went into emergency medical services along with the ED and then sometime in the ICU. So I've been somewhat hectic, might be one word. Another word might be crazy, and another word be many other things. But it's been opportunities to see a lot of different perspectives in the care of patients.
I would consider yourself an architect in emergency medical services, and you are a pioneer. I put you up there with Dr. Ron Stewart as well, and I'm sure there's multiple other physicians, but you're there. What got you interested in emergency medical services?
So the answer is a mistake. The mistake of saying yes to something. So my background, as I noted, was in trauma surgery. But my second year in the military, I was trying to pay off all my debt. So I moonlit in a series of three EDs. At the time, there were three in Colorado Springs. I was at Fort Carson Army Medical Center and was living in town, not at the base, because of the facilities out there. So I worked at the three hospitals in Colorado Springs, and I made a few dollars doing that, but kind of was interesting. So I went from there, obviously, to Seattle to do a fellowship year in surgery, at which point it was the old story of I said yes to go to Virginia Mason, and they said, no, we don't exactly like your lifestyle or your style, not so much in those words, but I had a very hard time getting along with those types of surgical specialists vis-a-vis city-county residency and a war. So very different. And maybe at that point began to ask the question, is this what I wanted to be doing for the future? So at the sort of three quarters into my time, my last year at Virginia Mason, I started working up in a place called Bellingham, Washington, which was a town of about 35,000, which were now about 130,000, and a county that was about another 35,000, which is another 125,000 or more. So we're about a quarter of a million, covering a big area. Furthest north was county in the continental US, about 2,500 square miles. And we got water, we got mountains, we got a little bit of everything to give you some excitement. So anyway, came up here, started working in the ER, and did not clearly understand the full perspective of EMS. At the time, ambulance service, and I use that with lots of asterisks and quotes and to use the term, was being provided by an operation called Crown Ambulance. And if they were a crown, it was a broken bronze crown. They were call them substandard was probably a compliment. I mean that seriously. I had patients come in cardiac arrest with no CPR, with a small oral airway obstructing their laryngeal region. I had people basically slabbed and moved. I had no pre-hospital care to speak of. In fact, we used to laugh, maybe with a little bit of seriousness, that the taxi cab was the more safe way to get to the hospital. In any case, at that point, there were some very foresight-thinking citizens. A pathologist, a semi-retired family care doctor, public health person, a orthopedic surgeon, and a few others. And then one or two of the fire department personnel formed a committee through the EMS Council. The EMS Council existed. It was actually state developed in approximately 1970. Now, this is early 1974. So now I'm up here in Bellingham, and I'm the new guy in town. And when I said I made the mistake of saying yes, they said, oh, hey, we need a new guy to help out with the committee. We're trying to improve pre-hospital care. And he said, hey, you were in the military. You did medevacs. You did land ambulances. You did wartime. You did all this great stuff, which was their kind of concept of the truth. I might argue otherwise, but I certainly had an experiential opportunity that many don't. And I said, oh, okay, well, I'll help. You know the mistake of the word, I'll help? So suddenly I was spearheading this group. Not, I think, because they wanted me so much as they needed a new tip to the spear. In any case, we convinced the local community, the city council at the time, to pass an ordinance creating standards for pre-hospital care. Now, at that point, the state had some semblance of standards, but they were vague, and the city had basically no standards. And so what we were able to do is we got the city council to set standards, and those standards had to be implemented. So on the day the standards went live, the local ambulance company, Crown, and a gentleman who headed them, came into the city council and the city offices and the mayor's office and said, we quit. You know, it's the old proverbial, we quit, but now we're going to have you over a barrel. So they quit, and the city council and the cities and the mayor said, bye, don't let the door hit you in the butt on your way out, because we had done some preparation. We had sent 10 Bellingham firefighters to EMT training. So now we had 10 trained EMTs. We had some out-county, I hate to use the word coordination, but semi-coordination. At that time, there was no 911 system. There was a dispatch council, what I call them pluggers. We pull up the cords and you stick them into different things as the phone calls came in. Linden area and Sumas area, for example, were dispatched by Border Patrol because we're on the U.S.-Canadian border. There was a variety of things. But in essence, we had people. We had people that were ready to step in. And so we borrowed an ambulance from the Army. The Army had a Nike base. I don't really remember what Nikes were. They were anti-aircraft missiles. And they were to save us from the Ruskies that were going to come in from the West Coast and over the pole. And they were there. They've obviously since long gone. And then we borrowed an ambulance from Linden, Washington, which had an ambulance. I mean, a lot of these areas were doing some level of care. And at 11:30 in the morning, after Crown Ambulance went out of business at 11, here we were. We were in business. And obviously, the rest is history. Speaking of Ron Stewart, I visited Seattle and I saw what they were doing down there for training paramedics, but I wasn't 100% convinced that we could do it in a small community. And I had met Ron, and he was in LA at the time. So when the fire captain is Gary Hedberg, who later became chief, and I went down to LA and we visited Ron. And Ron, in his intimate way, was just so always positive, but even more so. Yes, yes, you can. Oh, yes, and you can just see his hand motions as he's emphasizing what he's telling us. And then we came back with about 20 pounds of paperwork, teaching paperwork. And we came back and we started the first class in my living room. And one of our instructors was Jack Stecker. Now, Jack was a pathologist. He was our hospital, one of our hospital pathologists. And Jack was an interesting guy. Unfortunately, he did what too many physicians did at the time. He smoked. You know, he used to say physicians preferred Camels. More physicians preferred Camels. Well, I don't know if it's Camels, but he smoked. And he subsequently died in later years of lung cancer. Another side story. But anyway, Jack was one of our instructors. And we got to know each other, and we got to develop this first paramedic class. And this is in September-ish of 1974. Now, we just started the system in July, but I had been there since January. Jack came to me and said, hey, I got some buddies down in Portland who've got this interesting device. Now, let's go back a second. Our first paramedic class was in Evolution. They were not on the streets. We, in fact, at that point, had even purchased our first defibrillator. And in fact, at that time also, only people out of a hospital using defibrillators, for the most part, were physicians or paramedics. I mean, Pantridge and the flying squad in Belfast, and then the little Pantridge defibrillator were there. That was made up of doctors and nurses that went out to calls.
All right, before we get into where we're moving in the direction, how many years have you been in here in Bellingham?
Next January, it'll be 49 years.
How about that? That is just remarkable. One system, one medical director, and you've been here, and you've been the architect and the strength behind our system. And I think, you know, though I've only been here a short time, I've seen the impact. From my heart, I appreciate everything you've done in those last 49 years, and hopefully a couple more years before you decide you might want to go to Hawaii for good. Who knows? I don't know if your wife will like that, but that's a different story.
Let me correct you. I always have to do that to people. I always said, well, you did that. There is no I in we. We do things.
Right.
I happen to be part of it, but I really mean that. And I think people who know me understand that, because no I creates the environment. No I carries out the ideas. No I goes to...
I'll agree with there is no I in team, but there's somebody who has to lead that path, and you've done that. And I don't think anybody else can say that here in Bellingham or in Whatcom County that you've led that path. So that's where you and I would disagree. As usual, we do have these little back and forth conversations where you say something, I say something, and then we...
And then the truth comes out.
Somewhere the truth comes in.
Thank you.
Yeah, but the reason I really want to talk to you about is something that people don't know the story behind the AED, and you do. So let's talk about the AED.
This is where I was getting it with Jack. So Jack had several good friends in Portland. He actually had trained in Portland many, many years ago. So now we're in 1974. When everybody think this date and think about what the history will show. And when you ask people who invented the AED and when was it first used out of a hospital, if one in a million can tell you that, I would be surprised. I once stood up at a meeting and put an offer of $500 on the table. I didn't have that much money, but I offered it to anybody who could tell me who invented the AED and when it was first used out of a hospital. And, you know, everybody came up with Zoll and Pantridge and all these other people, Beck, Claude Beck, and all of them invented or were involved with the evolution of either CPR or EKG recording or the hospital defibrillator, which the first one weighed probably as much as I do. And it was actually AC current, and later was found that AC current would more likely defibrillate you than defibrillate you. So it went to DC current. At any point, so here we are in 74, just getting the system going. Jack's teaching anatomy and physiology for me in my living room to our first paramedic class. And he says to me, I've got a couple friends, two docs, an engineer, and a few affiliated people in Portland, because that's where he trained. He said, they've got this amazing device, and here's what it can do. It can sense breathing. It can measure EKG. It can decide what the rhythm is, and it can do the following. It can defibrillate, automatically, and when I say automatically, we're talking push the button and get the hell away from the patient. Because there was really no warning. In fact, I once tickled the fancy of one of the nurses, pardon the expression that way, but she happened to have her hand on the patient. And in those days, it was monophasic. It was not biphasic, where the energy is very different. It also could pace. Now, that sounds interesting enough, but let's add another dimension. Instead of coming from what we envision now, two chest pads or an anterior-posterior pad, it had an oral airway. Think about this, an oral airway with electrodes and a microphone at the very end. And then it had another pad that went subxiphoid. That was the ground, so to speak. So the energy went tongue, esophagus, into the pericardial area, and then out at the xiphoid. And you go, what's the sense of that? The sense of that's multifold. Number one, your first safety is most people won't take an oral airway unless they're really unconscious. So that's number one. Number two, the microphone theoretically would hear any breathing, real breathing. Now, today, when we're doing CPR, when we're doing all this, that would be a problem because it would lock the machine out. And then the third thing is that it had multi-sensors on it. So it had sensors for EKG, it had sensors for pacing, it had sensors for defibrillation. So it gave you a lot of opportunity covering a very, very good surface area, the tongue. And we'll talk about the dangers. People say, oh my God, it's going to burn up the tongue and esophagus and all that, which it didn't. That was the first interesting concept. The second was that it was like this Samsonite business case, and that had it weighed about 30 pounds with the capacitor. It was the capacitor that weighed everything. It was all analog. Everything was analog in those days. Unlike today, where it's still somewhat heavy, everything is pretty much digital. Digital and various types of boards, circuit boards. There it was. And so the docs that invented it was Stan Welborn, who was a cardiologist in Portland, and Bob Ruhlman, the engineer, and then Arch Dyack. Arch Dyack was a surgeon. Now, another piece of history, and this happened to my own father. When you had a cardiac arrest in 1965, which is about when he had his, in fact, it was a little bit before, he had it in the ER, and they didn't have fancy knowledge, understanding of really how to do good CPR. And they just cut your chest open, they did open chest massage. That's what they did. And Arch got tired of doing that with no success or with limited success. So he said, we got to get to these people outside the hospital. So Arch and Stan being the cardiologist, Arch the surgeon, conceptualized it. They then went to Bob Ruhlman and his engineering team, and they implemented it.
How long did that take?
Well, you know, the tale goes that they did that in 3 years. They started in the early 1970s, and by 1974, it was ready to be tested. So they started using, Stan Welborn started using it in the hospital in Portland, some, but getting cooperation. In those days, by the way, sorry to keep going back, but these are key points. Today, you'd have to go to an IRB, you'd have to go to multi-panels, you'd have to do all kinds of public acknowledgement and information. You'd have to have people that could put stickers on them that say, don't use it, do use it, whatever. Didn't exist.
And then get FDA approval.
No, then, well, eventually you have to get that. But the process of getting to that was very different. They were using it in Portland. No ambulance service there would touch it. Just wouldn't touch it. So all of their experience with it was in hospital. Okay. And they had not really been able to establish an out-of-hospital. So Jack Stecker came up with the idea. Well, hey, we got this dumb shit up Bellingham, just new into the business. Why don't see if he'll use it? So let me then take it up here. One, we did not have medics on the street at that point. So I was not supplementing or actually reducing care, because there wasn't pre-hospital delivery of AED or any kind of defibrillation, because our first class was in evolution. Two, how do I put it? At the time, the idea of an IRB and all these approvals was pretty much in its infancy. And maybe you were doing that, but it wasn't exactly the problem that it is today, or if it is a problem, or with the necessity that it is today. So we went ahead, and I went and met with the guys in Portland and spent a lot of time learning about it, learning the science, learning the implementation, and then we went, okay, now how are we going to do this? Well, this is also a little side story. I had gotten a gumball. These gumballs, like, you know, some of the old TV shows, you see the guy pops it on the roof.
Kojak.
Kojak, yeah. It was a Kojak light, in fact.
Strusky and Hutch.
Yep. A Kojak light. And in fact, that friend who actually wrote some of the Kojak episodes. But she once gave me the nickname of the Trauma Doc, so I ended up having a license plate at one point, Trauma Doc, but that's gone. But in any case, that's a side story. But I had the Kojak light, and I would respond to calls that sounded like a pager, that sounded like a cardiac arrest call. As you can imagine, time delay, implementation, getting to, and whatever. Many of these calls, by the time I got to them, there was not much hope. And implementation was sort of slow. However, on occasion, I was near the call. And in October of 74, on State Street in Bellingham, which is right along the water, is a path along the water, up high, and there's condos and houses. There weren't nearly as many in those days. Somebody went down not far from where I was, so my response time was probably 1 to 2 minutes. And I got there, and he was down, and the fire engine companies had not arrived yet, and the EMT units. We did have EMTs on our, and we had boxes, as we all call them, boxes, ambulances, that showed up. They literally had not arrived. And I got to the scene, and today, theoretically, I'd start CPR, and we do all these other things. But in those days, they got the monitor defibrillation, and then it's kind of the CPR. So I quickly inserted the oral airway. I'd practiced this on since Jack was a pathologist. I got a chance to go down in the mortuary at the hospital and practice putting it on. Nothing very tricky. If you can put an oral airway in, you can put this in. So popped it in, slapped it on, pushed the button, and stood back. And it charged. And it went whoop, and then it went boom, defibrillated. Okay? Did not have a warner. It just charged. And that was how I actually accidentally one of the nurses at the hospital, because I tried it there too. Again, don't put me in jail, but nobody was saying anything about having to get super permissions. And it charged, and the guy woke up. So that was the first use of an AED out of a hospital. He was pretty debilitated. He was about 76 years old, and he subsequently got admitted to the hospital, but he ended up in a nursing home and dying 3 months later. Pretty cerebrally debilitated. It worked. That was the key. It worked. Subsequently, I think I did 13 patients.
And how many of those did survive?
Three survived up to 5 months. Most of them didn't start exactly in great physical condition. And by the time I got to them, sometimes it was pretty long. I did use a couple times in the ER. It worked fine. And then, of course, they transitioned to care with other equipment. So follow up on some of those got a little bit, I don't want to use the word sloppy, but I guess the word is inefficient. But we did use it 13 times, and 13 times it either did nothing, it did something, or it tried to pace. Efficiency of pacing, you know, it was a lot of muscle movement, so it was really hard since the device does not have an oscilloscopic readout. So it's essentially a blind AED. Blind in the sense that a few of them now will have a little scope on them to give you what's going on. These were just push and go. And in any case, all right, so now here we are. While this is ongoing, I'm working with Arch and Stan and Bob and everybody, and we're trying to put this together for the world.
Yeah, how do you go from an oral airway to where we are today?
That's only a small part of it, actually. The bigger thing is, how do we tell the world that this exists?
Right.
And they had formed a company called CRC, Cardiac Resuscitator Corporation. All right, so now we've done that. We've used it. We've got cases in Portland. I've got cases. And what would you expect you to do next? You present it to the world's literature, right? I don't know where those rejection letters are, but I can tell you that one of the letters, I love the other one from the New England Journal of Medicine, because it basically said, you guys are a bunch of raving lunatics. The concept that anybody, but maybe a paramedic, certainly paramedics were on the scene in 1974, a doctor, a nurse, maybe a corpsman in the military, could do this, is just antithetical to the rest of the world. You're crazy. So in any case, I think we had about 16 rejection letters from a variety of journals. And in 1979, a journal which I'm absolutely sure everybody in your podcast reads every time they go to the bathroom. It's called the Journal of Medical Electronics and Instrumentation. And actually, I believe it still exists today, believe it or not. And in 1979, that journal published the article on the use of an automated external defibrillator. And that was it. That was the first publication. And there's nothing, you can go and look to you blue in the face, there's nothing in literature beyond that of an automated defibrillator. So lots of defibrillators. There's Pantridge's cool little one. I met Dr. Pantridge twice, actually, at meetings. And he had this cool little, it was like 5-8 pounder. The electrodes were actually on the device. It was like a brick with two pads. You put it on, hold it on the chest and push the button. Hope you didn't get shocked, because it was all monophasic. In any case, it was published, first publication. And at that point, a gentleman named Mark Vassu, doc I knew from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Mark was pretty well known in EMS at the time. And I say this very respectfully, because I thought he was a super person. However, his interpretation of the paper and of the concept, he missed a lot of the important points. So he wrote an editorial that I would summarize as follows. Neat trick, won't go anywhere.
Guess he was wrong.
Yeah, well, he wasn't wrong for 10 years. 10 years later, through various ruminations, permutations, and evolutions, the device evolved. CRC tried to sell some, never particularly, I don't think, made money. And later, Laerdal bought the rights and evolved the device. So 10 years later, a form of this device with modification came to the market. The oral airway dropped away because it was just too confusing to people, to the lay public. And I think we would have to go back to the article too. Article said, someday this will be like a fire extinguisher that hangs on a wall. I could send you how many pictures of the fire extinguisher with the AED next to it, and now the blood stopper kit next to that. That was where it began. I'm proud that I was involved. Every time I see an AED, I smile. Every time somebody's saved by an AED, I smile. And I think back to these gentlemen, Arch, Bob, and Stan. Never got the due they were deserved. I don't know how many years ago, but one of the supplements of American Heart wrote an article about the AED. But it was kind of obscure, you know. Well, it was sort of front page, back page kind of concept. It really never got publicity. And these guys they deserve accolades beyond accolades. I just happened to be a Klingon that was at the right place at the right time, that wasn't smart enough to know that you weren't supposed to do this unless you had all these permissions. And so the lives that have been saved kind of are the result of the lack of permissions. And if silly me saying yes to being involved in EMS, and silly me saying yes to getting involved with it. Because it would have been easy to just to say, this is lunacy. But then again, I've been known to be a little bit on the lunatic side of myself.
Just think that if you took the New England Journal of Medicine's opinion and editorial and saying this would not go anywhere, where would it be today if you and the others did not ignore that and just continue on that process. I've been part of a couple AED projects in my career, and I remember my one of my visits to Seattle was to visit Space Labs, because I was working with the Philadelphia Fire Department, and we were introducing the AED project, and we were looking at three, and they had one that was just perfect for the fire truck. Mm-hmm. It looked like a battery, it was rugged, and that's the one we chose. And I remember training our firefighters, and I remember the lieutenant saying, we're never going to use this. And we implemented it. Believe it or not, the first AED use in the city of Philadelphia was by this lieutenant. And he calls the next morning and says, I can't believe all that training, all this work. And thank you very much. I mean, just unbelievable how just a little bit of training and a little bit of knowledge and how the AED has kind of evolved in different shapes and sizes as well as uses. And there, I was actually in Vancouver for the first time at the airport, and one of the pictures I took was the AED hanging.
Well, interesting enough, we had 5 years here in Bellingham, PLI. Small airport, maybe 500,000 passengers a year. So it's pretty small. But it's been there, it was there 5 years before Seattle. And it has been used probably less than half a dozen times. But it's had a couple saves. So the question is, how often do you need to use it to have it? Once.
That's it.
Once in a lifetime.
That's it.
It's somebody's lifetime. And it's pretty impressive when you are able to see that. And today, they're ubiquitous.
Yep.
They hang on the wall. They might be next to the fire extinguisher. They might next to the blood stopper kit. They might be who knows where. But they're there. And every airline has to have one.
Right.
But here's the test for your listeners. How many of you knew this history? I will bet it's close to zero. How many of you would go to your leaders and ask the same question? Pretty close to zero. How many would you go to, of you would go to the manufacturers and ask the question? Now, Physio kind of knew, because Mickey Eisenberg, another true legend, and a man who I can't respect enough for all he has done with CPR, and the evolution of it, had my original AED that I used in his small museum. And Physio later had that in their cases at their facility. So Bob Niskanen, who was their science person for many years, he and I laughed and exchanged a lot of thoughts. And then I could not find the original article. And so Bob got it out of the archives and found it for me. And about 2 months later, while we were moving boxes and moving offices, I found it. Mm-hmm. But it's still in my drawer upstairs. And it's still, I think, a testament to people's conviction that you can do and you need to do things differently. And just because somebody said no the first time doesn't mean that the real answer is no. The real answer is not yet. And maybe not yet means I got to push you to yes. I got to get to yes, because we're going to save your life.
If you want to hear more from Dr. Marvin Wayne, he'll be at EMS World in Orlando speaking on what subject?
About video laryngoscopy. Is it changing the whole way that we provide pre-hospital airway management?
And that lecture is on Wednesday?
Wednesday at 2:30. And I get to go against all my buddies.
Yeah.
We're doing similar lectures of various topics at the same time. So it'll be interesting. I know these are all being recorded and they're going to be available online. I just did the Real EMS with Peter Antevi and his group. And I'm starting it with some of the cases I presented when we talked about pediatric airway management and the burned airway. If you've never seen real burned airway, not what you see that somebody tells you about and describe, you're going to see that in this presentation, among many other things.
Well, if you're going to be in Orlando at EMS World, I highly recommend attending Marv's lecture. I really appreciate you coming on my podcast again. It means a lot to me, so thanks for joining me.
Yeah, Steve, one last note. It's been a real pleasure having you here. And while we don't always agree on everything, that's probably a good thing. Because if everybody always agrees with you, it's either meaning you're a fool, or you've lulled yourself into mediocrity. And I like to think that none of us are either.
I would totally agree with you. So again, thanks for joining me.